I want to tell you about a new investigative podcast called She Has a Name. It's about a young mother who disappeared in Detroit in the summer of 1987. She Has a Name tells the story of loss and redemption, mending broken family ties, and facing the trauma experienced by countless individuals who've lost loved ones to violence. Join host Tanya Mosley and her nephew Antonio as they unravel the secrets of what happened to Anita Wiley. You can search for She Has a Name in your podcast app.
This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with Carrie Jr. II,
yes.
Show's producer.
How are you doing, Stephen?
So imagine that you are committing a crime with someone, and they go off without you during the commission of this crime and kill somebody or maybe more than one person, and you don't even know that they went to go do it. By the logic of a doctrine called felony murder, you could be held as responsible for that murder as the person who actually committed it.
Well, my first response, if I were in this hypothetical situation, is to say, wait, I had no intention of murdering or killing this other individual. This is something this other person did.
Yes.
And according to this doctrine, this statute, the intent is almost implied based off of the felony that was committed at the same time.
Yes.
And so we're talking about today a story of people, but particularly this reporting centers around a situation where one man was sentenced to life for an accident that happened far away from him.
What it does is it removes not just the idea of intent from the idea of murder, but even the idea of presence from it. In other words, because you decide with somebody else to go commit crime X, if crime Y results from that, whether you're involved or not, you can be held responsible. I mean, it's a very powerful reach of the law beyond the actual commission of a crime. And Sarah Stillman of The New Yorker wrote a story about this in 2023 and really used some hair-raising examples of what happens. People who end up in jail for the rest of their lives, prison for the rest of their lives because of this.
And felony murder, it ranges in circumstances. Like some of the reportings you found include situations where you could – the accomplice you are with could be killed – and you would still be charged or could still be charged with felony murder. And there is instance where if one of the accomplices is a victim of the police shooting him in the act of a felony, the other person who's committing the felony is charged with felony murder accomplice's death.
Yes, right.
Which to me is – that's a, like you said, a hair-raising, eyebrow-raising finding. I mean, she worked with the Yale Research Lab to kind of compile cases of felony murder and found in about 11 states a major discrepancy in which black men are disproportionately charged and convicted with felony murder, higher than the already highly disproportionate rates
of
incarceration.
This is like gasoline on the fire of criminal justice inequality. And again, if you go to southern states and take a look at this, that's where you see them lighting this fire more prolifically than other places. I mean, this is part of the criminal justice culture, in particular in death penalty states. And most of the very aggressive death penalty states, in fact, are in the American South.
Well, I will say some of the 11 states that have some
are not in the South.
Were, I think Wisconsin was one that she named.
Wisconsin was one.
In which like 76% of the cases of felony murder are black men, and you see. So, I don't know the regional differences, but I mean, I think once you have this doctrine on the books, because it became so popularized, she'll talk about all this stuff, but it becomes popularized in mass incarceration. It's just implemented as a way to kind of get these quick sentencings.
Yeah. Yeah. The story was so compelling and the research here was so penetrating that Sarah was awarded the Pulitzer Prize just a few months ago for the work that she did here. And we're going to talk to her today as part of a series of conversations that we're having with winners of the 2024 Pulitzer Prize. There were several whose work focuses on exactly the kind of inequalities that we like to highlight here on Created Equal. Sarah Stillman, welcome to Created Equal.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on
yes,
the show.
Yes, it's great to have you here. And I should say up front, congratulations on winning the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting in 2024. Tell me, were you surprised?
Of course, yes, I was unbelievably surprised and very grateful.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I do want to talk about your story, the work here that was honored by the Pulitzer Board. Your story centers around one man, and I want to start with him and what happens to him. I think for most people, they'd have a hard time quite understanding what happens to him. Sadiq Baxter is robbing cars along with a man named O'Brien Oakley. O'Brien engages in a high-speed chase with police and kills two bike riders. Baxter is nowhere near this accident when it happens, and he's not directly responsible for it. But both he and Oakley are sentenced to life without parole. Tell me how this happened.
Yeah, I was certainly really surprised when I learned of this story, and you got it exactly right. I think it's important to note Sadiq and his friend were basically going around to unlocked cars in a neighborhood, and they fished out some loose change, a pair of sunglasses. This is what I would categorize as, you know, not a good idea.
But these are petty crimes.
Not the same as a first-degree murder charge, which is what he wound up getting for this unbelievably tragic situation, which is, as you described, someone called the police when they saw him taking the sunglasses and the loose change from their car. And then the police came and arrested Sadiq. He was literally in handcuffs in the back of the vehicle when police spotted his friend driving away from the scene. And a set of officers chased that friend against police policy for high-speed chases. And then that friend wound up accidentally striking the two bicyclists in this really tragic incident that killed them both. And they both men, as you described, got first-degree felony murder charges. Mm-hmm. So the way this was able to happen is this area of the law that a lot of people have never heard of, and it's called felony murder. And the concept can sound reasonable to many people at first glance. It's essentially that you should be held accountable and equally liable for murder if someone dies in the commission of a felony. And it looks different in every state, so it varies greatly across the country. But in Florida, it means a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole. And so in Sadiq's case, that meant that even the judge in his case essentially said, look, like, my hands are tied. The judge himself seemed to believe that this was not a fair outcome, but that he had no choice based on the way the statute is written but to sentence Sadiq to spend the rest of his life in prison.
And why does this exist? What's the thinking behind this legal doctrine that says, look, if I'm nowhere near the commission of a murder, I can be held equally responsible for it as the person who commits it?
I mean, I think one obvious rationale behind the statute is that people believe it could help prevent crime and could help prevent people from getting involved in things that could inevitably lead to something more dangerous happening. What was interesting to me, having spoken to so many different people who have served time on this charge or been charged with felony murder, I don't think I've yet to meet a single person who actually even knew of the existence of felony murder before they committed the original crime. And so, you know, I think there's been good scholarship showing, right? The deterrent value has not been particularly impressive. But I do believe, you know, I think one thing that's really important to note is that some states have laws that allow you to, you know, hold the person accountable for whatever the crime is that they actually committed. So it's not a matter of saying, you know, Sadiq was completely innocent of any wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. I think he, in fact, took accountability for and pled guilty to the charges of the burglary from the unlocked vehicles. And in Florida, frankly, that amounted to, I believe he got something like 25 years for that part just of the crime alone.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to remember, especially within the punitive systems that we have in many parts of our country, that it's not as if he wasn't going to be held accountable for a crime, and specifically the crime that he actually committed, as opposed to this other crime that transpired outside of his presence.
Yeah. But the essence of this still, I think, stretches beyond what most people would think is logical responsibility, right? This idea that that somebody who not only doesn't pull the trigger or is not immediately responsible for the act that causes the death can be held responsible. Where does that come from? What is the kind of origin of that?
I mean, it has disputed origins. There's a number of historians who have kind of nerdy debates about this, and in a various array of law articles that I won't bore you going too deeply into. Essentially, some argue that it comes out of English common law. I think one thing that's important to note is that, you know, although way back in the day in England, you could be charged and held accountable for a murder if you had been along in the commission of a robbery, for instance. That then later was changed in British law. They abolished it a number of decades ago. And then in almost every other Commonwealth country, they did the same. So mm-hmm. America is somewhat anomalous in not only having not gotten rid of this across time, but in fact, you know, across the span of the war on drugs and the rise of mass incarceration, we've seen more aggressive, more extreme punishments that result in mandatory sentences. So I think America has a kind of unique approach to the felony murder doctrine.
Yeah. And as you point out, this is about prosecutorial discretion, right? If something like this happened, it's the prosecutor who decides who will face which charges. And so, mm-hmm. you know, in Sadiq Baxter's case, for instance, the judge is even prevented from interfering in the sentence because mm-hmm. once he was convicted of it, there's a mandatory sentence associated with it. But also, the prosecutor has decided that he should face that penalty. That's an awful lot of power to vest in mm-hmm. one person.
Mm-hmm. And that's why we see such disparate outcomes depending on what court you're in, what prosecutor you're facing, what is your geography, even within a given state with a clear statute, this could be charged so differently. And I think one of the most alarming parts of this reporting process was really looking at the extraordinary racial discrepancies in how this charge gets brought, because, you know, we already know, I think most people who've observed the U.S. criminal legal system know mm-hmm. knows that it is, you know, often results in racially disparate or outright racist outcomes, or that it disproportionately in particular affects Black communities. But when we looked at this specific charge, we found sometimes it was even way further than the average racial discrepancies. We found multiple jurisdictions where across the span of more than a decade, 100% of the people convicted of felony murder were Black. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we saw upwards of 90 or 80% Black convictions in places that were not even majority Black. And Wayne County is a place where those racially very disproportionate numbers are something that we documented. So I do think that's a really worrisome outcome, is that, as you were mentioning, prosecutorial discretion, the ability to choose, you know, who will be charged with what and who is guilty by association versus by what they actually did or chose to do. I think that's a really big part of the racial discrimination we see in how this charge is used.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say one other quick thing about that, which is that another thing I learned talking to so many people affected is that, as many people listening will know, so much of our system now is resolved through plea bargains.
Yes.
And so a lot of the damage that's done, I would argue, by this statute is really invisible in the data, because a lot of what you see is people who, oftentimes, like kids, for instance, who went along in a group, maybe 10 of them went to the park, and one of them acted in a way that none of the others had foreseen when they thought they were going along on a minor marijuana deal. And instead, you know, one of them got shot by the dealer or shot someone else. All of the kids wind up charged with murder and are potentially in some states facing life in prison, and they plead to something else. And just the very fact that you can be charged and facing going to prison for the rest of your life obviously incentivizes plea bargains that might not otherwise have happened.
Yeah. You also talked about how difficult it was to even identify some of these felony murder cases in some states, and that they seem hidden by design. Talk about what that means and what that meant for
No, those. I don't mean to sound naive, but I did embark on this project somewhat naively. I was teaching an investigative reporting class at Yale, and I said, oh, this will be a great opportunity to teach the students how to use public records, see all the amazing things you can find that way. So we collaborated through the Yale Investigative Reporting Lab, and we divided up all the states, and we sent out public records requests, and we said we want to see all the data on who's locked up in every state for felony murder. And then what we got back state after state after state was people saying, honestly, we don't keep this data. We have no idea. We don't track this. We can't provide this to you, or we're not going to provide this to you. And I can give you the very specific example of Florida, where Sadiq Baxter got charged and then convicted, because when you look at the initial charging documents, his charge says first degree felony murder. And again, that's a mandatory life in prison sentence. When he goes to court and gets found guilty due to the fact that he does plead guilty to the robbery or to the stealing from the cars, he then gets sentenced to first degree murder. So if you look him up in the system, what you will see is a first degree murder charge, but you won't be able to find in the data that this is a felony murder charge. So no one really knows the exact explanation for that. But what we do know is the outcome, which makes it very, very difficult to measure who is in on this charge and to figure out why.
Right. When you talk to the people who are sentenced for this kind of crime, this kind of dissociative, I guess, crime, what do they say about their culpability and their responsibility and the fact that they're being held responsible for something they literally did not do?
I think a lot of people carry, rightly, a great degree of pain and sometimes shame for the death that did occur. Because I do think it's really important to underscore, I'm not trying to minimize in any way the reality that is so painful that existed in all of the cases I documented. There was a death, and often just an unbelievably tragic and unnecessary death. And sometimes it came at the hands of the person's co-defendant, but in other cases, it actually came at the hands of police or other actors at the scene. And sometimes it was, that part was intentional. And sometimes, as in the case of O'Brien, he was fleeing police and that was not intentional, but it nonetheless resulted in people losing their father, people losing a loved one. And so I think Sadiq and O'Brien live with that every day and are very real and very clear about that, about the depth of their regret, about the depth of their apology that's insufficient, and absolute clarity about accountability. I think what Sadiq struggles with is the fact that, you know, accountability for him would have meant something very different. It wouldn't have meant spending the rest of his life in prison, also costing taxpayers an extraordinary amount of money, going through a lot of trauma, being separated from the ability to parent his own child. And quite remarkably, in his case, one of the reasons it really stood out to me and one of the reasons I decided to focus on it is actually that in Sadiq's case and in O'Brien's case, one of the families that had lost their loved one, the father who was killed on his bicycle, that family actually spoke up. The three kids of that individual, especially Ian Malkin, who I spent a good bit of time talking with about the case, his son, Dean Malkin's son, Dean was the person who died, they actually spoke up and said, we don't want Sadiq and O'Brien to go to prison for life. We don't think that that's a just outcome. And in fact, as the victims of this crime, we want something very different from that. And that it actually causes us more pain to know that not only did we lose our amazing beloved father, Dean Malkin, but we also now are knowing that another father is going to lose his child or another child is going to lose her loved one to prison. Yeah.
Okay, we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will continue this conversation with Sarah Stillman about felony murder. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
We're back with more Created Equal, and we're talking with Sarah Stillman. She is a staff writer at The New Yorker. She is the 2024 Pulitzer Prize winner in explanatory reporting for her piece, Sentenced to Life for an Accident Miles Away. It takes a look at the legal doctrine called felony murder, which can see people who have not actually committed murder but were with someone who did, were committing another crime with someone who did, sentenced as though they were the actual murderers. Sarah, I want to spend some time talking about the kind of extremes to which this legal doctrine often goes, as if it's not extreme enough to imagine people being punished for things they didn't do. But I want to talk about Lakeith Smith. In that case, and the circumstances that outline even a more shocking implementation of this law. Tell us who Lakeith Smith is.
Yeah, so I met Lakeith's family in Alabama, and Lakeith, as a teenager, had struggled with a bunch of different traumas growing up, but he got involved in a situation where he and some friends went to rob some video games from a house. And someone called the cops. They show up. And while the kids are fleeing, the police wind up shooting one of his good friends, one of Lakeith's friends. And it turns out that because of the felony murder statute and the way that it works in Alabama, Lakeith was actually the one who was prosecuted for his friend's killing by the officer. And a grand jury ultimately looked into that and found that the officer's use of force was justified. And Lakeith was the one, even though he was a juvenile at the time, he was actually charged as an adult with murder and is still, in fact, serving time right now.
Yeah. So to be clear, he's punished because he participated in a crime that the police responded to. And in that response, they killed his friend. He's being held responsible criminally for that death, for the death of his friend.
That's correct. And not just – I think it's important to underscore he's not just being held responsible. He's being held responsible for murder.
For murder.
And so he was a 15-year-old at the time. He and his four friends broke into these two unoccupied homes in Alabama. And when Lakeith basically ran into the woods, and then that's the point at which one of the officers shot and killed his friend, who was a 16-year-old named Adante Washington. And it was Lakeith then who was charged with murder for the killing at the officer's hand.
Yeah. And I guess I raise that to bring up, again, the lengths to which this is used. I mean, that seems to stretch credulity even more than the sort of run-of-the-mill cases of felony murder. But it does, again, raise the question of the purpose of this kind of mm-hmm. doctrine, this kind of prosecution. Was there an inquiry even in the trial into whether this was Lakeith's idea, for instance? Like, was he the person who instigated this behavior in the first place? And was that even part of the consideration in either his guilt or his sentencing?
Yeah. So the statute looks so different in different places, but mm-hmm. one of the key facets in many places is this idea of foreseeability. Was mm-hmm. it inevitably foreseeable that a murder could occur in this context. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in Sadiq's case, for instance, like, would you have foreseen that, you know, opening an unlocked car and taking money from it, which is obviously a bad thing to do, would result in a bicycle accident miles away after a high speed chase? Like, I think arguably because the officers were violating their own written policy regarding high speed chases, mm-hmm. that I think there would be a very good legal argument that that was not foreseeable, but that's not an argument that the jury bought. And so I think based on the way the statute's written in Florida, like it seems like felony murder was a not surprising outcome of Sadiq's prosecution. And I think mm-hmm. similarly with Lakeith, I think what makes these cases particularly hard to fight if you're charged with them is that, you know, de facto, if you did commit the underlying felony, you're then automatically guilty of murder. And there's just, again, not a lot of room for discretion. So I think that's one thing that makes it particularly complicated compared to other charges in our system is that, yeah. like, Keith, and in fact, many people who think, like, you're a kid, you're at the time he's a teenager, he's thinking, okay, well, I know I didn't murder someone, so I think my odds are good if I go to trial. That was, I think, part of his logic.
Right.
And so he goes to trial. And in fact, the other kids ended up taking a plea. They did a bunch of years and then they're able to get out. Whereas Lakeith thought, okay, I'm very confident I didn't kill someone. I'm going to take this to trial. And then because the way the statute is written, he kind of almost automatically lost without a fully fleshed out understanding of it. And in fact, with a lawyer who simply, it won't surprise you because I think we all know this about the overstretched nature of public defenders, sure. wasn't able to represent him particularly well. And in fact, he had a resentencing hearing at which even the prosecutor said, look, like I think he literally said, I wouldn't want her as my attorney. And so I think that's a pretty common outcome I saw as well. People wind up getting punished for taking the case to trial because they don't fully understand the way the statute works. Right.
Well, and there's a great irony, I think, in what you were just talking about, which is this question of foreseeability, right? Would a reasonable person have been able to predict that the behavior that they were engaged in might lead to, a situation in which someone was killed? But here we're talking about a 15-year-old, and we know, and the Supreme Court has even said, we don't hold children to that level of responsibility because they can't make decisions like that, that their brains aren't fully formed, that that judgment doesn't come into focus in quite that way at such an early age. I mean, there's something really cruelly ironic, I guess, about that in this case.
Yes, I think that's right, that we've seen the Supreme Court validate the idea that even just at a strictly neurobiological level, the brain of a young person doesn't have that same capacity for forward thinking, responsibility, understanding. Nonetheless, again, I don't mean to make excuses for serious circumstances that result in death. I think that's, again, where it's important to just distinguish that people could be held responsible for the charges of what they actually did. Because I think we're presenting right now some of the stories that are the easiest to understand in terms of the extremity and the delta between the crime that they actually committed and the crime that they were charged with and convicted of. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also a lot of much messier cases where it's still worth having a conversation about, is this policy serving us well? Like, a good example, I think, would be a robbery where you go along with a gun. In that instance, do we feel comfortable with the idea that someone would be charged with murder if the homeowner then shot their friend, their co-defendant with whom they were robbing the house? Like, is that a foreseeable outcome? I think that's a lot more complicated. I would argue there's still a lot of space to explore. Do we benefit from the current statutes as written, or would we benefit from really finding ways to hold people more specifically accountable for what they didn't do? But just to be realistic about the nature of these charges. Although I want to say one more quick thing around that, which is that I thought perhaps cases like Sadiq's or cases like Lakeith's that we just went over, I thought those might be kind of cherry-picked outliers. But having looked very deeply at this across the last 2 years and spoken to, you know, well over 100 people, I found case after case after case like that, because so many of these cases involve young people. Mm-hmm. Many of these cases involve survivors of intimate partner violence, where the gender dynamics were very clearly that a woman was going along in a situation where she was being subjected to violence. Mm-hmm. And many cases involved, for instance, a woman driving a getaway car for her abusive partner. In fact, there was a Michigan case that I'm planning to write more about, LaShante Mobley, in which, you know, her child died, and the fact pattern appears that he died at the hands of her abusive partner, and he was ultimately acquitted of murder, and she went to prison for felony murder,
and she went to prison,
and she got life. And so I think it's really important to just note that these aren't just wacky anomalies. These are actually baked into the fundamentals of what you get when you structure a charge in this way.
Yeah, I know you briefly referenced Wayne County earlier, but we haven't talked about the fact in deeper detail that Michigan is one of the states that has a felony murder statute. This is something we do in the Great Lakes state.
Okay, this is a very odd mystery to me. So if you look up the term felony murder on Wikipedia, I don't know if this is still there, but a while back when I did so, Michigan is widely cited both there and elsewhere as a place that has eliminated the felony murder rule, which we very clearly found talking to women who were incarcerated in Michigan that that was not the case. And the statute has been narrowed in specific ways, but those ways nonetheless have still resulted in many women going to prison for crimes that were committed by their partners, for instance. But there's also an array of other ways that it continues to be used. And so there are quite a number of people who are incarcerated under the charge, both legibly, sometimes it's listed as felony murder. But again, as we discussed with the complexities of the data, many times it's hard to even find it in the data itself. So it's a very murky thing to fully understand.
Right. It's not called felony murder, but it operates in that way.
In some cases, it is called felony murder. Like LaShante's case would be a good example, that she was actually charged with felony murder. But in many cases of women that we spoke to in the system, when they explained the fact pattern of the case, it was prosecuted under essentially a felony murder theory, but the charge just looks like a standard murder.
Like a regular charge. Yeah. I also want to talk about how you detail some states using this charge, felony murder, for cases related to unauthorized abortions. I want you to explain what's going on there and whether that opens up another real can of worms.
Yeah, the abortion context is really interesting. It really stood out to me when it came to the Dobbs decision, the one overruling Roe v. Wade. In Justice Alito's opinion on that, he actually described abortion as essentially what he called the proto-felony murder rule that way back in the day, apparently in the colonies, if a doctor was found to have given a potion to a pregnant woman for the purposes of an abortion, and if that woman died, that doctor could be charged with murder. And so that was used as a kind of justification in overturning Roe, that this is like a longstanding precedent. And so there are many states right now where, as we see abortion getting criminalized, I think one potential implication of that is that in states that have any felony could result in a felony murder conviction, or in states that may choose to enumerate abortion or any kind of termination of a pregnancy as a crime, that could then result in people who assist in that, or even the woman herself being charged with murder. So I think this is an emerging area. So I think it's not something that we've seen people push for these laws, but we're not currently seeing, as far as I know, widespread prosecutions of this. But we have seen that in the past in some states, women themselves have been charged with murder in the context of the pursuit of abortions.
Yeah. Okay, we need to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Sarah Stillman of The New Yorker about felony murder. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Back with more Created Equal, and we're talking with Sarah Stillman, staff writer at The New Yorker, who is the 2024 Pulitzer Prize winner in explanatory reporting for her piece, Sentenced to Life for an Accident Miles Away. It takes a look at the legal doctrine of felony murder, which can see people who are not directly responsible for killing another person but were involved in activity that led to someone's killing be sentenced as though they were the killer. Sarah, I want to talk a little about the I guess, the most extreme examples of felony murder that I know of. And those involve the death penalty. I spent 5 terms covering the U.S. Supreme Court and spent a lot of that time, in fact, looking into death penalty cases in some of the states that use it most prolifically. And one of the things I remember really clearly are the instances in which people who were not the actual killer in the case of a murder, sometimes faced the death penalty, the ultimate sentence in our criminal justice system, because they were along for the ride, so to speak, or were part of the precipitating behavior. This seems another real reach, right? With regard to the way in which we hold people responsible for their actions. You are now responsible for your life in some of these instances.
Yeah, it's quite surprising that, you know, even right now in Oklahoma, there's a forthcoming case of a man who is facing the death penalty in a situation where he was, I believe, not the trigger person or the person who perpetrated the actual killing. And I believe just the way you referenced earlier, the Supreme Court precedents around juveniles and the juvenile life without parole case that said juveniles aren't supposed to get life without parole. And nonetheless, we see that still being contested in certain states. It's quite similar with the death penalty and felony murder. So there were some cases that essentially said that wasn't a just outcome in the majority of instances. And yet we still see there's ways that has been, I don't know if overruled would be the right word, but we still see that playing out in certain states, and Oklahoma right now is one. So yes, you can have kind of the most extreme consequences, including death. And even Sadiq's case would have been, I believe, like death penalty eligible.
And when we think about death penalty and the imbalances that exist in death penalty prosecutions, the racial imbalances, they look in some cases similar to what you have found with felony murder. But one of the things I remember really acutely about those prosecutions was that the race of the victim had at least as much to do with the prosecutorial determinations as the race of the offender. In other words, killing a white person was more likely to result in, you know, the prosecutor filing a death notice as if you killed an African American or someone of another race. And I wonder if that plays out in the wider felony murder context as well.
It's a really good question, and part of what makes the lack of data so frustrating is it's a hard question to answer. So I think there's a lot of questions we really need answers to, especially given the amount that taxpayers are paying to incarcerate for life many people on felony murder charges. But we just, at this stage of the game, I don't think anyone's managed to answer that for the reasons we were kind of discussing earlier. I think there's a few states that have worked really hard to try to document things like that. Like there's 2 mothers in Minnesota whose daughters got incarcerated on a felony murder charge, and they made it basically their life's mission to unearth the data, to change the law. And they recently succeeded in both getting their daughters out and also just getting a lot more visibility on what is the actual nature of how felony murder is playing out there. And the stats they found were quite remarkable. They didn't find, you know, the exact answer to the question that you just posed, but I do recall they found Black individuals were being charged at a rate 5 times that of white people, and that we haven't talked about other groups yet, but Native Americans there were 10 times more likely to be charged with a felony murder charge. So, or at least to be convicted. So, I think there's a broad array of things that we don't know the answer to. Like Native American communities and how they're affected is a really good example. Mm. When we tried to dig deeper there, what we found is that the five states with the highest Native populations, most of them were also the states with the least data visibility and the most terrible record keeping regarding that. So I don't know if that's a purposeful correlation, like the right. states that are obfuscating a lot of this, but it just makes it very tricky to answer questions like the very good one you just posed.
Yeah. I also really remember the struggle that that defendants in cases involving the potential for the death penalty had with representation, and you mm-hmm. you referenced this earlier, in the death penalty context, you know, you have this bifurcated trial, right? There's a guilt phase where you determine whether somebody actually did what they're accused of. And then there's the penalty phase where they determine what that sentence or the consequence should be. And the critical nature of that penalty phase in determining the value of someone's life and the totality mm-hmm. of someone's life before you pass judgment on it in a way that mm-hmm. that might end it. And I wonder how that plays out in the felony murder context. How much do the attorneys who represent people accused of felony murder, how much time do they get to spend or do they choose to spend, presenting mitigating evidence, you know, things that some that you referenced about some of the people you wrote about, things from their background that might explain their involvement in some of these crimes and maybe make a jury think differently about the sentence.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to the issue with the mandatory sentencing because there was not a shred that I could find of mitigating evidence entered on Sadiq's behalf because at that point, the judge, again, just said, my hands are tied, but there's literally nothing, no matter what I think about this, there's nothing I can do. So you're right, there's these two stages. Once he had pled guilty to stealing from the cars, essentially he'd just given up the murder case, unbeknownst to him, because... Mm-hmm. I think there would have been some potential good defenses he could have used, and he tried to marshal those on his own because his public defense was arguably quite inadequate. And that honestly was probably one of the more inspiring things I encountered in the course of doing this piece, is that the expertise of the individuals who've gotten these charges, who spent so much of their lives incarcerated on them, the amount that they've gotten to know the law, gotten to understand all the different potential defenses, and had to really represent themselves across the years. I mean, Sadiq is a remarkable jailhouse lawyer, and he actually learned jailhouse lawyering from someone who was from Detroit, who had gotten incarcerated in Florida, a guy who... basically saw him in pretrial in jail playing, I think he was playing chess or playing checkers, playing some game in the jail. And this guy from Detroit came up to him and said, hey, I see that you're wearing this particular uniform. That means you're facing a serious charge. Mm-hmm. I don't know why you're messing around playing with games. You need to like really focus on learning the law and defend yourself. This guy from Detroit, Eric, he actually wound up defending himself and getting off on the charge he was facing, really mastering the law, learning how to file civil lawsuits for the abuses that they were facing in the jail. And he taught Sadiq how to represent himself. And now the only reason that Sadiq has a chance of getting out is because for the last many years, more than a decade, he has been rigorously defending himself and has filed pretty sophisticated legal motions explaining why he believes he should have a chance because his sentence, he argued, was a violation of the Constitution for being cruel and unusual and overly extreme.
Right, right. A violation of the Eighth Amendment.
Exactly.
Yeah. I want to end talking about what the, I guess, which direction the tide is headed with this. You know, we live in an era where there are so many parts of the criminal justice system that are being rethought, where incredible reforms are being pursued. There are lots of experiments taking place. We have one here in the state of Michigan that was being led by our Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and some other officials to really rethink the idea of how punitive criminal justice is. This seems like, you know, one of the more obnoxious, I guess, examples of how punitive it can be. Has there been much of a movement to try to reform this, or maybe just remove it from legal doctrine?
Yeah, it's a fascinating moment, I think, as we see two directly oppositional forces in our culture right now. Uh-huh. I think one has been this tremendous evolution towards recognizing the ways mass incarceration isn't serving us. And I would argue that Michigan and Detroit, the Detroit area specifically, is this incredibly robust and creative area of imagining new alternatives. So there's a lot of incredible both like abolitionist groups, but also just creative thinkers who are thinking about how do we get at the root causes, because we all want to be safe. We all want to be protected from crime. We all want to have people who've done crimes heal and not do more crimes. And so I think really asking that set of questions, there's like a blossoming movement of people who are building real alternatives to the failures of mass incarceration. But at the same time, I think we see a return to some of the kind of 1980s, early 90s kind of tough on crime mentality, as we see a surge in addiction and people being unhoused. And instead of addressing the root causes of that, we see sometimes a kind of knee-jerk return to these policies that I would argue have not served us well. And I think in the felony murder context, you see both of those things. So in some states, there are these incredible movements like the one I mentioned, led by mothers in Minnesota who've been directly affected and led by incarcerated people. Similarly, in the state of Pennsylvania, which also has a very severe felony murder doctrine that also results in life without parole, automatic sentence. That's a place where incarcerated people have actually done a ton of organizing. They've been involved in serious litigation efforts to challenge the constitutionality of the doctrine there. And so we do see real change. California was one of the first places to have significant legislative change, and they've saved taxpayers many millions of dollars by shifting those sentences and doing resentencing in some of those felony murder cases that were of the type we've described. But then we also see, conversely, this new push into even more punitive sentences in certain terrains. So one very good example would be how we're thinking about dealing with addiction in certain states.
Yes.
And the example of how in some states they're choosing to prosecute people for felony murder if they sold drugs or gave drugs to someone who had a lethal overdose. And I think those charges are particularly devastating because often they come from people who gave drugs to a family member or loved one, both of whom the dealer themselves and the person using were both involved in an addiction. And then the person who's just lost their loved one is also now essentially being construed as and being prosecuted as a murderer. And whether that actually is a good idea from a public health policy, having spoken to many people who are addiction experts and public health, looking at it through a public health lens, I think there's a really good argument that that actually dissuades people from coming forward in the context of an overdose and actually leads to even more kind of fear and secrecy, as opposed to the kinds of solutions I would argue we really need around mental health and drug treatment.
Yeah. And this is a state issue. In other words, there isn't much at the national level that that could be done to push states one way or another. Is that not?
Yeah, there's a federal felony murder charge, but I think the majority of what I saw happening really happened at the state level and comes out of state-based conversation. So a lot of these moves to criminalize drug dealing in this particular way have come at the state level. And they've come, again, from a very real place of people trying to reckon with the unbelievably traumatic and painful impacts of addiction. I think it just really necessitates a better cultural conversation and empirical conversation about how do we really deal with and address the profound challenges of people being unhoused, people having serious mental health issues that aren't getting the treatment they need, and people suffering from addiction.
Yeah. Okay. Sarah Stillman of The New Yorker, it was really delightful to have this conversation with you. And again, congratulations on winning the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah, thank you so much for having this conversation. I really appreciate everyone listening.
So I think the lesson, Carrie, is be careful
what you don't do.
Don't do and who you do it with.
And who you do it with.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for me, the conversation, much needed. I love the way she explained how her reporting played out. I don't know if she spoke to this point in the conversation, but there, the man who called the police on Oakley,
mm-hmm.
his car was the car that I think Baxter was robbing at the time.
Yes,
he was convicted of, like, I think healthcare fraud for millions of dollars and got 10 years. And yet Baxter, who stole maybe a couple hundred dollars of change
out of his car,
is sentenced to life in prison.
Got a life without parole. Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible imbalance, and it does, I think, trace to many other kind of systemically unequal features of the justice system, things that go, date back to before the Civil War and injustices in our system that have been there since the beginning. That'll do it for us on Created Equal. Be sure to listen to our recent episodes at WDET.org, and we would love if you would subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is done by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.